From FingerLakes1.com, this is a Sunday Conversation, and I'm Josh Durso. This week, my guest is Yates County Sheriff Ron Spike. He's here to talk about law enforcement, the past, present, and future, what it's going to look like and what it's going to take to get more people involved, not just in terms of policing and community policing, which we hear a lot about, but recruits, people who will be those working in law enforcement. Sheriff Spike has a ton of experience, and it's a really great conversation, one that you definitely don't want to miss. We're going to pick the conversation up right when we're starting to get into what law enforcement looked like 20 years ago, 30 years ago, versus what it looks like today. Enjoy.
All law enforcement agencies right now is recruitment and retention. That seems to be very challenging. The number of individuals that are taking the civil service tests for police officer, peace officer, probation, or any related field, correction officer as well, dispatchers, seems to have dropped by 60-70% of what it was several years ago, and those number of applicants are not there. And then when we start the process and do background investigations, we have some issues with individuals passing the psychological test and other issues like that. Hearing seems to be a concern now on the requirements for passing that. And eyesight, of course, has got to be corrected close to 2020. And so those are all kind of concerning issues that are out there. Just getting the number of applicants to be interested is something that we're going to have to work much harder on. The way it looks, even the state police are their numbers are down as well as of those that are interested in this profession, and so we need to work on that.
Mm-hmm. And how much more difficult is it recruiting for a small rural or a smaller rural department like the Yates County Sheriff's Office as opposed to some of the larger counties and the cities, which I would assume are probably the quicker to be filled departments?
Well, the interesting thing there is that the same training is required whether in a small department, whether on a 5-man, 7-man, 10-person agency or a 100-person agency or a 1,000-person agency. You have to go through the same minimum standards of training. And So the smaller agencies' retention is the big concern. Once we get someone hired and get them into the basic training school, irregardless of their past education, they still have to do this. Mm-hmm. That's about a 9-month process, and then they go through a field training period of several weeks. And if they choose to leave us, then after that, within the first couple of years, they can go on to larger agencies that pay higher wages and have a higher salary, more benefits and things like that. And so those larger agencies will take them on a lateral transfer and have themselves already a trained individual to put to work. And so we do lose, I lose every year one or two, it seems like the last few years, to larger agencies that are paying a much higher wage. So it's very concerning to be able to do that retention.
And when it comes to the retention, in terms of just what it looks like to be a law enforcement officer in 2019-2020, is part of it the risk and the workload just not jiving with the pay that comes along with being a deputy or working on road patrol or something to that effect?
Well, the pay runs as a wide range,
right,
with from agency to agency, and depending upon what jurisdiction you're at, as an example, a lot of the state troopers are making in the six figures if they've been on the job for 4 or 5 years. And I've got deputy sheriffs that are making $55,000-$60,000 a year, so it's about half that, and that are doing the same job. They back each other up, they work cases together, and everything else. And so, that has a stress mental factor that that individuals start to think about a little bit as well. That's just one example, but there's awful lot of competing interest out there, especially with computer technology, things that have to do with social media and those types of issues that seem to be of interest to others instead of law enforcement. And there's a certain stigma now that some feel that with law enforcement and with the what you see going around the country and different issues with use of force, mm-hmm, and different other liability areas, that unfortunately somebody that is untrained somewhere in some other state can do something that's wrong and cause a ripple effect on others that may be interested in law enforcement, because we can often get painted with the same brush when it's really not true. And so we take great pride in training, and we do a lot of training, especially in this Finger Lakes area. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of training. We work together with the state police, with the local police, with the city police, and with the other county sheriffs. We all work together. We've got something called the Finger Lakes Law Enforcement Academy. We all meet monthly, and we do a variety of training. We have a basic school going on now that has different officers from different municipalities all training together, and a lot of camaraderie there from that. So we take great pride in that. I've come to learn that without a doubt, my best assets are the men and women that work for me. Mm-hmm. And if you can keep them well equipped and keep them well trained, and they do a great job. There's some great professionals out there that understand the business and understand community service. Mm-hmm. And community policing, they talk about community policing, and I say, geez, the sheriffs, we might have invented it. We seem to practice it every day.
And to that end, you mentioned the training and sort of the awareness that you raise through that community policing and that community building within wherever you're serving. Is that the answer when you look long term in terms of rebuilding forces across the spectrum to get that next generation really interested in law enforcement as a career?
Yes, we have to engage people when they're younger. I like these programs where there's intern programs that are going on, these law enforcement explorer programs, anything we can do to get the attention of younger people to see this as a career. And to get into law enforcement, it doesn't matter whether state, county, or local. It's a career that has a great satisfaction for public service, and there's a great feeling that you're helping others, mm-hmm, and contributing to your community, and that makes a big difference.
And you mentioned the recruiting challenge. Obviously, a lot of concern there. What does the future of law enforcement look like, or policing look like, if those shortages aren't sort of addressed and the numbers are rehabilitated?
Well, we're very all law enforcement is very concerned that our numbers are going to continue to dwindle if we don't turn this thing around, and you have to have a certain number of individuals in any police force in order to not only answer calls for service and be out there doing investigations and trying to apprehend and do arrests. My gosh, we have so many more things placed upon us. I think about back when I first started back more years than I want to talk about ago. That the number of weeks that I went to school was about 8 weeks, and now they end up going to school 26 weeks for most basic schools. And like I say, by the time you get somebody trained, that's about 9 months has gone by. And so it's a long time. I mean, what other job in government or what other job in most other private sectors do you hire somebody and yet you don't have them as a resource to use as far as a law enforcement officer goes? What other one do you hire somebody and 9 months later you finally get to use them as a resource? That's just part of the challenges that we have. And then even you could start out with a class of 30 people in a training class and you might end up with only 24 or 25 that can actually get through it. We've had issues with individuals not being able to pass the firearms qualifications, not being able to do the physical fitness that's required of them, and so we work very hard to get individuals trained and ready for those tests.
And when it comes to the recruitment aspect of it, and even that delay, the lag that you were talking about, that 9 month lag, what kind of burden does that put on any agency like the sheriff's office in terms of scheduling and staffing and not letting your guys burn out? Or how do you prevent that?
Well, it's really challenging. And anyone in any law enforcement agency that does scheduling, God bless them, because it's really something to try to keep up and try to stay away from mandatory overtime, which is unfortunately what's happening with a lot of the agencies, especially in the Finger Lakes area, is that you have to resort to mandatory overtime in order to have enough individuals working a particular shift. We're a 24/7 operation,
right?
And so that's every day you have to have a minimum number of people in order to answer the calls and even provide backups for some of these things. I mean, domestic violence calls alone, we have a lot of officers that could get hurt with those types of things if we don't send two deputies to those types of calls at least. And so there's those types of incidents out there that we get very concerned that we've got adequate enough, minimum enough staff to handle the workload.
Is that another one of the factors that you think or you hear is sort of luring deputies and officers from one agency to another agency? Maybe the promise or the hope that they might not have to work those longer shifts, or maybe that the schedule might be a little more flexible.
Well, there's different. I mean, there's what we're seeing now in law enforcement is you have 8 hour shifts, you have 10 hour shifts, some are gone to 12 hour shifts. And if you read anything out of the Bureau of Justice statistical people that do all the justice research from the USDOJ, they talk about the 10-hour shift being the optimal schedule if it's doable. Mm-hmm. It may or may not be doable depending upon what kind of staff. It is a compressed schedule. But so having enough staff to be able to answer calls for service and to provide backups is a real concern. We just don't want to get anybody hurt. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the issues we're dealing with now, we deal with a lot more substance abuse issues we're running into a lot, and mental health issues. Mm-hmm. And seemingly, mental health and substance abuse tend to go together.
Overlap.
More so than a lot of people realize. And we're even seeing that at the jail. Those types of issues kind of run together. And so having adequate staff in the jail to deal with those with substance abuse issues is always concerning. One of the things that's been a real positive, especially in this in the Finger Lakes area, is the FLACRA folks have been able to put together this PEER program, and that's PEER program, which if we have an overdose where officers have responded and maybe have administered Narcan to an this opioid issue, then we can get a hold of the peer folks, and they'll respond. They'll either come to the scene, or they may go to the hospital, or they'll follow up to try to get somebody who's suffering from addiction, knowing that addiction is treatable, to try to get them that help. And a lot of times, these peer individuals have been trained. They've been through it before. They understand it. And I've been really pleased with that particular program, and we've come a long ways to be able to have a referral that way. There was a time when you could have someone walk into our department that was suffering from addiction and asking for help, and you had nobody to turn them over to. Mm-hmm. You know, how do I hand this person off to get them help? And now we do. Mm-hmm. And thank goodness that's come, because I've been very concerned. We went through a period of time where we had people that were in jail that had a substance abuse issue. We did our best to provide treatment and counseling while they were in jail, but they get out. Some of them go right back to using the same dosage of an illegal substance that they did before, and sadly, within a couple of weeks, they're dead. And those types of things, So we're trying to do a lot more programs on releasing somebody from jail back to the community. We call it transition from jail to community program. And these peer folks have been really helpful that way, working with social workers and working with people that have been trained to deal with psychological issues has been very helpful. And so we see that as a positive.
And to that end, does it feel effective when you're working in sort of that daily grind, and your deputies are working in that daily grind? Does it feel like do programs like these make it feel like you're really making progress in an issue that feels like it's getting bigger by the day?
The peer program has really been positive, so that's a positive program. The other program we've tried on some individuals that have been getting released from jail that had an opioid issue is having them go on what's called Vivitrol, which is a non-narcotic type of drug that's once it's administered is good for 28-30 days, and then you go through that cycle. And we've known some individuals that have gone on that program and were able to stay off of opioid abuse. And thank goodness for that. So that's very concerning. It's, I don't know. The other challenge, which is coming down the pike as far as substance abuse goes, of course, is the legalization of marijuana. And we in law enforcement know that that's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. Thank goodness it got slowed down. It wasn't put in as a part of the budget process this last cycle around. But of course the legislature hasn't closed yet this year, and even this last couple of weeks they're even talking about bringing it back up again. But which we know is going to happen, but. You know, we just want to make sure that let's slow down. Let's make sure we've covered all the consequences. Let's covered all the issues that are going to come up, and how we're going to deal with those issues, and how law enforcement is going to interact with those issues. And there's just a number of issues that are very concerning. That all one has to do is look at Colorado and some of the other states some of the things they're going through now. I mean, I talked to the sheriffs out there. And they're telling me that they're dealing on a daily basis with black market marijuana. And if you can sell it out the front door with your license to sell marijuana, and of course the state gets tax on that, but they'll sell it out the back door, you know, they don't have to pay the tax. And it doesn't take you too long to figure out that, hey, I can make more money that way. And so they've got quite an issue out there right now with the black market side of it. And so it's very concerning working on all those issues. I know it's coming, but I just hope things can get worked out and we can understand all the consequences.
To that end, what is the, if you were sort of going to identify one or two big concerns with marijuana legalization, Just in terms of real life implication for your deputies, for people who live in places like Yates County, Seneca County, mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. What are a couple of those things that you sort of bring to people's attention?
Well, a couple of the issues that are out there is that I think back years ago when I was doing criminal investigations, say back in the 80s, we dealt with marijuana then too, but it did not have the potency that it has now. And my gosh, the potency is three times what it was. And so the THC is stronger. And you get very concerned that there could be some relationship between mental health and heavy use of marijuana as well, recreationally. Do we know everything we need to know about that? That's concerning because it's a lot more potent than what it was before. I guess the big concern with law enforcement is that when you're dealing with another substance that we deal with all the time, which is alcohol, and if you drink alcohol to an excess and you drive a motor vehicle, then we have the ability to do a roadside test, and we have some kind of an instrument that'll give us some kind of a reading. And so we know that anyone that's over 0.08 is intoxicated according to the law. Now, there is no perfected roadside test for marijuana and marijuana driving under the influence of marijuana, which is driving while ability impaired. And so you have to rely on a blood test and other things. There's a lot of work, research going on right now on the use of a swab that an officer could take a saliva sample and possibly do a roadside test. It's not perfected yet. And in New York State, there's something called the Fry test. And that's kind of where the court recognizes a scientific result of something that can be accepted in court. We haven't had that yet. And so there's a lot of new research. There's a lot of new equipment that's being tested as to whether we can make this saliva test perfected so that we know if someone is driving under the influence of marijuana. So that's a big concern right now. The other thing is, marijuana will stay in your system for several days, and so is it. If someone is stopped and you could prove that they had marijuana in the system, does that mean they were driving while impaired? Or was it 7 or 8, 10, 20 days ago that they actually used it? So it's got to be fair to both sides as well. So there's a lot of concern about driving while ability impaired, and we hope that there's a lot more research done on that and when it comes to enforcement.
Now, one of the things that's been talked about a little bit over the last month and a half or so, it's gotten some headline attention, the reduction for the DWI numbers and DUI numbers from 0.08 to 0.04. Obviously, that has not been approved or passed or signed or anything like that. But it's being discussed. And I'm curious what the law enforcement take is on that reduction and what it sort of means, especially with the backdrop being legalizing marijuana.
Yeah, well, some states have I think some states have reduced that what we call a BAC, blood alcohol content. I know that once you get below 0.08, you get into like from 0.06 to 0.08 can be an impaired situation. Currently, the way law enforcement was always trained is that. For every drink of beer, glass of wine, shot of whiskey, that should give you about a 0.02.
Okay?
And so if you have two of those types of drinks, 0.04, 3, 0.06, and so on. And then for every hour that, for every hour after you've consumed, your body will oxidize off 0.02. And that was always the old general rule of thumb when it comes to training and how many drinks someone has had. The problem with that is if you've got a combination of, say, marijuana drugs or some amphetamine or barbiturate or something with the marijuana, whatever. I know this, is that out of the last year's statistical information on DWI arrests in my county, that... about 60% of those arrests that the individual was also in possession of marijuana, either in their vehicle or on their person. And so it seems to be becoming more and more prevalent with the intoxicated driver that both are involved.
Does reducing it then, I guess my follow-up is, does reducing it, would it necessarily help or hurt in terms of policing it and ensuring that, does the reduction mean something, I guess, is what a lot of folks seem to be curious about, because we see a lot of, you know, a lot of times when there is a DWI arrest, the numbers are, the BAC numbers are well over 0.08.
Yes, yeah, we average, our average was, last year was 0.15, was the average of our BAC of all of our arrests. I think our highest was 0.28 or 29. It was close. I've seen them higher than that. But you know, people who consume alcoholic beverages on a regular basis sometimes build up a tolerance,
right?
And so it affects different people different ways. Depends if you've how fast it gets into your system, how much food you've eaten, you know, things like that can make a big difference. So. You know, from the last research that's been done, they've come to the conclusion that this, you get up into that four to five drinks within an hour, and you're what they consider intoxicated, and that you're not going to be able to operate a vehicle the same way that someone would if they were not.
Now, similarly, over the last the last 2 to 3 years, there's been some discussion about. Essentially a textilizer to push back against or to help investigate when someone's been using a smartphone or some sort of smart device while driving.
Right.
Is that something that from the law enforcement perspective would really make a difference for you guys and help you guys sort of navigate those investigations?
Well, you know, texting while driving is very concerning. And we're seeing that distracted driving, which that's one of the factors, is causing a lot more accidents than what it was, and so there's got to be a better way to control that looking at that device. It's one thing to look at it; it's another thing to talk hands free, which, you know, you're still got your eyes on the road. It's mm-hmm. all about where your eyes are. And if you're trying to type on a smartphone and drive at the same time, then good luck with that, because it's unfortunately causing accidents. And so we try to discourage that as best we can. And sometimes that's in an accident investigation, we have to take a look at that, or trying to get a hold of the phone, or take a look at downloading whether it was being used at the time of the accident or not. So it's a very serious issue that we hope people are taking note of.
And in terms of technology and social media, obviously you have been doing this a very long time. Is it making policing easier, or is it making it more difficult? It's interesting. We hear sort of a mixed bag. Some folks in law enforcement say it's awesome. We can communicate better with the public. We can build better rapport. We can get information faster. Others say there are a whole slew of challenges that come along with it that make it really difficult to manage. What's your perspective on it?
Well, it has its good and its bad, that's for sure. And one of the things that we're seeing with social media is that especially with the under 30 folks, is that they're very interested in that form of communication. And so it's important for law enforcement to be able to be on social media as well, and communicate and have the ability for individuals to. We've had great luck with individuals that can give us a tip on a crime tip that it comes right into our dispatch, and then we can tell the law enforcement about it. And so that's been very helpful. But, you know, again, texting while driving is a real issue. And we need to discourage that as much as we can.
And my last last topic I want to talk about. Obviously, you have been doing this for more than 25 years. You are running for re-election. This is some, what is it that keeps the fire and the drive going year in and year out, given how difficult the work is, obviously?
Well, you're always trying to help your community, I've always been dedicated to public safety. And again, as I said earlier, my best assets are the men and women that work for our agency and work for our county. And they're a dedicated bunch, and I have great respect for them and their abilities, and I try to provide them the equipment that they need and provide them the training that they need to get their job done. And in order to stay contemporary, sometimes that you have to try to find grant money to do these types of things. Some of the current challenges is we need to upgrade our body cameras in order to be able to photograph different situations that you find yourself in. That needs to be done. There's the non-lethal weapons that those technology continues to evolve and change. And you've heard the term taser. You know, the legal term is conductive energy device, and we need to upgrade all of those types of things. And communications is a big concern. I wear many hats in Yates County, more so than a lot of sheriffs ever think of wearing. I also have to be in charge of the public safety communications, all the radios and all the towers. I have to have administrative oversight over the corners. That gets interesting as well. And in charge of animal control, and then you get back to the regular things like running the county jail and your police services and your 911 dispatch and your stop DWI and your court security. And so it's a pretty diversified job. But I love it. I always have. And it's kind of my life. And I make mistakes, but we try to learn from them and move on. And I just appreciate all the staff. That's huge to me.
Can't do it without a good team, right?
No, you got to have a good team. There's no I in team either. And so we appreciate all they do.
And I appreciate you coming in today. Thanks a lot for the time.
Oh, thank you.